And at this point in time, I would like to open a work session to introduce committee bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning. I would move the following legislative council drafts to be introduced as committee bills. They are LC 2704, 2775, 2338, 3118, 3207, and 2837.
Senator Gourley moves that LC 2704, LC 2775, LC 2338, LC 3118, LC 3207, and LC 2837 be introduced as committee bills. And as you all know, this does not mean that you support or oppose these drafts. Any discussion? Any? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Cordman?
Excuse.
Senator Cruz?
Excuse.
Senator Gourley?
Aye.
Senator Monson?
Aye. Motion carries, and the LC drafts as stated will be introduced as committee bills. I'll close the work session on introduction to committee bills, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 531. And do we have testimony? And Shannon, would you please describe the bill?
Senate Bill 531 increases the number of physician assistants on the Physician Assistant Committee from 2 to 4, clarifies the authority of the Board of Medical Examiners to license physician assistants.
Thank you. And Marshall Koba, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. Happy President's Day to you. With me today is Francine Velosa, who is a practicing PA with 31 years of experience. The bill before you today does two things for PAs, and the administrator's description was as the bill is printed, but there's been some discussions recently, most likely Friday, where we have changed the bill a little bit, and of course we don't have an amendment to present to you today, but we'd like to present to you the concept. The bill, the main reason for the bill is the PA committee, which is advisory to the Board of Medical Examiners, which is the board which licenses and has enforcement actions against PAs. Has a minority of members that are PAs, and we are the only one that we know of that is in that situation. There's five members on the committee, and only two of them are PAs, two of them are MDs, and one of them is a pharmacist. In discussions with the pharmacist and with the BME, I believe the agreement that we've come to that we'd like to present to you, and we will get amendments drafted, would add one PA, so there would be three PAs on the committee instead of two, and delete the pharmacist. And the history of the pharmacist, as I understand it, is the pharmacist was there when we were originally putting together the formulary for PAs, and that's no longer an issue. And in talking with Jim Thompson, who is the executive director of the Pharmacist Association, he didn't have a problem with it, and I know that the BME is supportive of this proposal, and Anaheim is here to make any comments if necessary.
The second a question on that. Are there any other organizations that have a minority on their advisory committee?
Madam Chair, in the research that we looked into, no. I don't believe that there is. There was one committee, I think, had six members, and three of them were of the advisory committee, of the profession of the advisory committee, but there was none that had a minority that were of the advisory committee.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to add something to
and
that.
And introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm Francine Velosa, and I'm a PA, and I've practiced in Oregon since 1975. I was originally a nurse before I became a physician assistant, and I've been in pediatrics my entire career. Many of my patients in the past have been patients covered by the Oregon Health Plan, and I just want to honor our first PA in the state, who was an African-American, Josiah Hill, who I know Senator Gourley has honored in this assembly in past years. But I wanted to say, to kind of comment further on your question, Actually, when you look at boards across the state who regulate that regulate professions, the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners is the only licensing board in the state that does not have represented on its actual board members from the professions that it regulates. For example, there are no PAs who are on the full board of the Board of Medical Examiners. So the PA committee, I feel, serves a vital interest in articulating the issues of PAs in their practice sites and in the diversity of settings in which they are practicing: rural medicine, specialty care, hospitals, HMOs, private practice, migrant health centers. All of these various settings are places where PAs practice. And by increasing the number of PAs on the PA committee, there's more of an opportunity for the voice of people who are actually practicing in those settings to help the committee. And one of the physicians who serves on the committee also serves on the Board of Medical Examiners, and he can then bring that forth to the board if there are questions about scope of practice and licensing procedures.
Great. Any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you very much and good morning. And I would just like to thank the witness very much for saying the name of Josiah Hill in association with the measure before us. Josiah Hill was a great man, a wonderful health practitioner, and he was also someone who drew the community's attention, the northeast Portland community's attention to lead exposure and children's exposure in particular to lead and lead paint and other issues related to children's health. Again, just thank you very much for mentioning his name. He is sorely, sorely missed, mm-hmm. and was dearly loved, dearly loved. Thank you.
Okay. Any other discussion?
And, Madam Chair, the second part of the bill clarifies that the BME can indeed license PAs. In getting bills drafted this year, the Legislative Council took a more in-depth look and looking at our statutes, and it was brought to our attention that I think the word that the drafter used was, Mr. Cheek used, was weak licensure law, and this strengthens that, and we are very supportive of that.
Thank you. Ann Hine?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. I don't have anything to add to Mr. Koba's testimony. I just want to confirm that the Board of Medical Examiners has agreed to support the bill as amended.
All right. All right. If there's no further discussion, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing and wait until the amendments come, and then as soon as they come, will you work with Shannon, and then we can get this back on record. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 531. Josh, do you want to just go and see if Kate's still there? Because then we can do, we're going to do SCR. I mean.
Pass her down. Here's the gazelle.
Is she here? No.
Yeah. She was just the one who just happened to talk.
Okay. Could you call Schrader to see if he's ready to go? And we are going to be in recess until we get someone here to testify. Another committee bill, and I would like to open a is it a public hearing on a work session on introduction of committee bills?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator
I move LC Draft 3443 be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Gordley has introduced LC 3443 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Now I'll close the work session on introduction of committee bills. And we will resume being in recess. Go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 429. And I know that Senator Schrader was going to be here to introduce the bill, but John, are you willing to come and testify since you are...
Speak of the devil.
Speak of the devil.
And he walked in.
Senator Schrader, would you come in? I just opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 429.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm Senator Kurt Schrader, Senate District 20. I appreciate the committee's indulgence in hearing Senate Bill 429. The Senate Bill 429 actually grew out of a conversation with some of my health providers in Clackamas County. And it fit into one of the things we're trying to do in Ways and Means, which is this continuous improvement concept. How can we deliver quality service and yet do it in a timely and very, very cost-efficient manner to make our limited resources go as far as they can? And the gist of the bill basically is to say, and it flies in the face of some of the conventional theology around this building in the last couple of years, how can we provide our most vulnerable the services they need in the most cost-efficient manner and yet not bog things down in bureaucratic red tape? By that I mean there's been a big push to make sure that those that are receiving services in our state are eligible. And I support that, of course. However, the lengths to which some of our caseworkers are asked to go to determine whether or not certain people are eligible, given their experience in the business, has been such that they feel they're wasting their time, and they feel they're wasting taxpayer money. If they were able to use the federal criteria for determining eligibility and do some independent audits over the course of the biennium or the year, most of the counties are on annual budget basis, they feel that they can actually free up staff time to make sure they can reach more people and provide more services with very little, if any, increase in fraudulent claims. And I thought that was worth investigating. The bill, the goal of this bill, whether it says it imperfectly or not, is to go down that route. We've had conversations with the department. The Department of Human Services feels, well, we already sort of do that. And I guess my thought was, well, that's good that you think that and good that that's your goal, but there seems to be a disconnect because my people working in Clackamas County with seniors, people with disabilities, and the AAAs are not exactly feeling that same way. So this is a bill that kind of challenges the conventional way we do things. It's a bill to try and figure out, is there a better way to do things? And depending on what you hear here today, Madam Chair, I'd be interested in convening a little work group, maybe with the department, some of my local people, other legislators or providers that are interested, and see if we can just do a real good job.
That's great. And I have talked with the department and haven't talked with John Mullen yet, but it looks like that maybe we can get a work group, and if that could be then coordinated with, have the staff help coordinate that then.
Great.
All
thank
right.
you.
All right. John Mullen. Does anyone have questions for Senator Schrader? Yes. Senator Cruz, then Carter, then Gordley.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Schrader, just somewhat confusing, and you'll probably work all this out, I suppose, but in Section 4, when you say interest earned on liquid assets, and then you kind of get fuzzy after that, my assumption would be that if they have liquid assets that are low enough to qualify, the interest is going to be negligible. So I'm not sure you want to put those fuzzy words in there.
Well, and Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, yeah, these are one of the things that we need to work out. We have LC that is somewhat new to the building and trying to get to the gist of what I just described to you. And I'm certainly not an expert in all the details, but I think you're sort of correct. There's a way to kind of massage this bill to make sure it's very simple, very straightforward, allow the people who do the financial asset and income determinations to figure out if this person's, you know, good or not good in what they're saying, and then they always have the opportunity to pursue things a little bit further. But I think that's the sort of thing the work group could work out.
Yeah, well, just to follow up, I guess if we're gonna ask for a waiver, it should be a little more defined as far as, I mean, if you want a waiver to say, if they're right below the line and their interest would kick them over the line, you want that interest to be disregarded, you should just say that. So rather than set up a matrix. But
our goal is to actually have less bureaucratic, you know, definitions, right, and allow the caseworkers to do what they do best.
Senator Carter.
Senator, are you concerned or you're trying to be much more expedient with them in terms of how the caseworkers determine who's over that 100%? Because when I look at 414.750, which is one of the statutes regarding how the department shall verify all the resources, what was the limitation in terms of why they would not verify all resources?
Well, they are allowed and encouraged to do a lot of verification. And over the past couple of biennia, we've seen where the department's been under siege, if you will, for not being as thorough in determining eligibility. And so I respect the department's concerns about being seen as soft or inefficient or inaccurate in who should be getting public services at public expense. So, the intent of the bill is to say, well, isn't there a smarter way to go about this? Isn't there a better way to use these caseworkers' times and expertise in determining who is actually eligible? And I guess I fall back to an analogy. I mean, if it's good enough for the Internal Revenue Service, you know, to have us so supposedly on the somewhat honor system with some backup documentation, and they do a fairly good job of collecting their resources and what have you. Isn't that type of system applicable here? And hopefully you'll see from John Mullen data showing, you know, how they've done, you know, with the system that's been in place in Clackamas County, and you know, the degree of bad claims. The contention here is that more effort in will yield very little positive results. It will cost us more money to pursue eligibility beyond what the federal criteria are, and a few common sense things here for our state, than we'll reap in returns by restricting that. So it's just a good issue for us to come to grips with. If the work group comes back and says, hey, we don't need a bill, we're all on the same page, we understand, I'm perfectly fine with that. I'm just trying to make the state run a little better and respect the local and state resources.
Yes, follow up.
Senator, if the task force should come back saying that we don't have the staffing patterns in place to accommodate the loosening of the situation, are you prepared to give staffing levels to that end?
Well, actually what appealed to me a great deal about this is that if the task force comes back and says, hey, we like your concept, they should need a lot more staffing. What they should ask for is, Senator, hey, if you give us this slightly less restrictive eligibility criteria to go on, let us keep the staff we have, don't take the so-called savings you get from that, and let us pursue things more, let us reach more people, let us do better work. So it's actually, again, in this continuous improvement concept, where if this concept is valid, they won't need more staffing, they'll be able to use the current staffing much more efficiently, have it go further, again, to take care of more people without having to hire a whole lot of new people.
Thank you.
Senator Gordley?
Thank you very much, and good morning, Senator Schrader.
Morning.
And by the way, I'm not one who would refer to you as the devil.
At least I got one.
Nor an angel, somewhere in between. I would like to wrap my mind around, have a better way to wrap my mind around the concept that I hear you describing. And so, an example or examples of how you've seen this be being applied would help. I did hear you say that, you know, our goal is to look at how we can provide the most vulnerable with the services that they need without getting bogged down in red tape. But an example or two, please.
Well, yeah, I would probably defer to John Mullen on that one. Okay. For more accurate examples. You know,
John, do you want to come up? Any other questions for Senator Schrader? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Senator Schrader, you are aware that Congress adjourned without passing the safety net, right?
No, I was not, actually. Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just to add to your misery, I thought I'd throw that out.
That's another impossible task that the President has given me to look at, so I look forward to dealing with it. I will excuse myself
yes,
to the
thank
certified
you,
smart
Senator
people
Schrader.
You had before you. Thank you.
Thank you. Introduce yourself, John, and...
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mullen. I'm a constituent of Senator Schrader. I live at 1019 Hazelwood Drive in Oregon City. The reason that I'm not testifying as part of the Oregon Law Center is that this actually arose during my tenure as director of Clackamas County Social Services, where we did programs for elderly, people with disabilities, low-income residents of the county. And over the years, we, our agency, wrote a number of major papers on simplifying workload that we submitted to seniors and people with disabilities. There were some improvements that were made, but basically Senator Schrader has really captured the general issue very well, is that basically what our interest had been was to make sure that we could do the best by the public applying for benefits, not asking them for a lot of additional information that was not required federally, and also because of the pressing workload of staff. We did a fair amount of research, and there is actually quite a bit of research on simplification at the national level. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities talks about a number of ways in which eligibility can be simplified and has done research to demonstrate that it hasn't increased markedly any problems with people being led on programs that weren't otherwise eligible. The fundamental thrust of all of this is that people are fundamentally honest, and actually most people are somewhat reluctant to apply for services. So I think, Madam Chair, in some of the work that you did on the Healthy Kids initiatives, there was quite a bit of discussion about making the eligibility process as streamlined and simplified as possible. And I think that's to everybody's benefit.
Just to point out, we went from 12 pages application form to a 2-page application form.
Yes, and Madam Chair, I think that's just really terrific. There are a number of examples out there in a variety of states about how to do just that, about simplifying applications, making telephone interviews more possible for family-friendly kind of situations. And then also, as I think the committee is very much aware, is that when people sign up and apply for benefits, they are stating that what they are presenting is truthful, and so there are always consequences for people that might be fraudulently trying to obtain benefits. But basically, again, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities does demonstrate, the research does demonstrate, that that's really not much of an issue as far as they can determine.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Mullen? All right.
And, Madam Chair, if it's okay to stay up here for a bit, Nicole Palmateer is here from Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and I'm very much in support of her testimony, but she asked me to be part of the testimony so that I could provide any clarification if there was any questions.
Okay. Well, I have does Nicole want to come up now, and then we'll have the department.
Will the senator ask her a question again? Were you asking for examples, Senator?
I actually heard an example.
Oh, you did?
In
okay.
In his testimony. I did. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Pommetier, and I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. We are the AAAs who provide services to seniors and people with disabilities, and we are delighted to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 429. Workload simplification is a major issue for us. As Senator Schrader pointed out, with limited resources, the amount of quote-unquote paper shuffling we have to do is incredibly cumbersome and limits the ability of our case managers, program managers, to be able to provide the real services that we would like to when we're filling out paperwork, determining eligibility over and over. And Senator Gorley had asked for an example, and I will not read this verbatim, but one of the things that we had talked about during the interim workload simplification, for example, was the yearly determination of financial eligibility for food stamps at the state level. Every year, a client must complete a 10-page application. There are supplemental forms. You also have to provide proof of the information provided in the application, and that has to be done on a yearly basis. It's estimated that that takes approximately 60 to 90 minutes per client every year. The federal guidelines for federal food stamps is on a biennial basis. If we change from a yearly to a biennial to follow with the federal standards, that would be an incredible impact just in that one single case. The area agencies have a number of different examples like that, and our directors would be very delighted to participate in a work group to talk about this issue because we are interested in being able to maximize the very precious resources that we have. So we are in support of this bill, and we ask that you continue this along. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Nicole? All right. We have Senator Farioli with us. And if you don't mind, I'm going to just close the public hearing on 429. And I would like to open a public hearing on HCR2 and Shannon, would you go ahead and describe the bill?
HCR2 resolves that the 74th Legislative Assembly will mourn the passing of President Gerald R. Ford and extend condolences to his family by sending a copy of the resolution to his wife and children.
Good morning, Madam Chairman.
Good morning. Happy
State
President's
Senator
Day.
Ted Farioli from Senate District 30. And happy President's Day, Madam Chair, and to you all, members, and particularly to Mr. President, Senator Courtney. Thank you for allowing this hearing. I think it's an important effort that we make today to recognize a person who pulled the nation together in a time of extreme doubt and cynicism. He has been called a steady hand in the storm and an honest broker of compromise. He set a sterling example of what it is to be a public servant. In a statement before the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration during the vice presidential confirmation hearings November 1, 1973, he said to his colleagues in the legislature, "I am not a saint, and I am sure I've done things that I might have done better or differently or not at all. I have also left undone things that I should have done. But I believe and hope that I've been honest with myself and with others, and that I've been faithful to my friends and fair to my opponents, and that I've tried my very best to make this great government work for the good of all Americans." He was sworn in August 9, 1974, and during the swearing in as President of the United States, he said, "I have not sought this enormous responsibility, but I will not shirk it. I believe that truth is the glue that holds government together, not only our government, but civilization itself. That bond, though strained, is unbroken at home and abroad. In all my public and private acts as your president, I expect to follow my instincts of openness and candor with full confidence that honesty is always the best policy in the end. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule." Colleagues, these words were spoken by a man who was called upon by his nation to face a period of time during which virtually every value of this country was called into question, whether or not we had a rule of law or ruled by individuals who sought power for power's own sake whose ends seemed to justify any means, and who left young people, including myself, wondering whether or not the future of this country would be as bright and glorious as our storied past had been. He was a person, in fact, who succeeded Spiro Agnew as Richard Nixon's vice president following the Agnew resignation, which, as you recall, was under a storm of controversy due to corruption in office. He was sworn in as president at age 61 years, 26 days, following Richard Nixon's resignation on August 9, 1974. And he selected Nelson Rockefeller as his vice president. He left office January 20th, 1977, following the election loss to Jimmy Carter. He, in fact, was an ordinary man in an extraordinary time. He collected stamps as a hobby. His favorite breakfast was orange juice, melons, English muffins, and tea with lemon. He was a middle American with middle American taste. His favorite food was pot roast and red cabbage. He was an ordinary guy, not noted for being terribly agile. You know, one of the things that were probably a trademark of President Ford was his inability to enter or exit a helicopter without bumping his head. You know, we all saw that. And, of course, on the golf course, he was a pure terror. I remember once watching him tee up a golf course and hit a spectator with a golf ball with a drive. It was one of those things that he just seemed to have so many incredible talents that we all expected, I guess, that he would exhibit the same grace that others had. We have before us House Concurrent Resolution 2, and I would like to defer to my good colleague from the Senate, Senator Brown, to talk about President Gerald R. Ford and the Senate concurrent resolution that honors him.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown represents Senate District 21. Appreciate the opportunity to be here in support of this concurrent resolution honoring President Gerald R. Ford. My colleague made some wonderful remarks, just to add a few points to my written remarks, which I believe are in front of you. What I liked both most about this man is that he remains so active after his presidency. I believe physically playing golf, but also contributing to his successor's administrations. He was named as an honorable co-chair of the Council for Excellence in Government. He was also an honorable board member of the committee overseeing the rebuilding of the World Trade Center. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom and also the John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award. He certainly led a distinguished life and left an indelible mark on the nation, and I ask for your support of this measure.
Any questions? No. Discussion? Yes, Senator Carter.
Just a comment, because I want the record to be very clear about this president's position on affirmative action. He was very, very supportive of affirmative action. I sat and watched his whole services being carried out on television, because I think Mr. Ford and Mr. Carter have not gotten their just dues in terms of history in this country, and it certainly is showing up in his death now, his great work, and I'm sure the same will happen with Jimmy Carter. So I support very much this measure, and thank you guys for bringing it forward.
Any other discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes. just briefly, because it hasn't been mentioned, Senator Ferriola did bring it up that he put the country first, and I think the prime example of that was the fact that he pardoned Richard Nixon, which probably cost him any chance of being elected himself, but it was, as we found out, in the best interest of the country to put that behind us, and that definitely was putting country ahead of self, and I admire him for that.
Madam Chair, just to close, the I think the comments of good Senator Cruz point up the issue in good contrast. Upon receiving the John F. Kennedy Profile and Courage Award May 21st, 2001, he left some really excellent advice for all of us as political leaders. He said, "The ultimate test of leadership is not the polls you take, but the risks you take. In the short run, some risks prove overwhelming. Political courage can be self-defeating, but the greatest defeat of all would be to live without courage, for that would hardly be living at all. And so I think he urges us to do things that have an element of risk, but show that we put the welfare of the folks, you know, that we represent and the welfare of the state of Oregon before our own. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Okay, I'd like to close the public hearing on HCR 2, and I'd like to open a work session on House Concurrent Resolution 2. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 2 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves HCR 2 to the floor with a due pass moves that we adopt House Concurrent Resolution 2. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. There are moments in the conduct of our business as a legislative assembly that we have the opportunity to be a part of marking our history, marking our national history, and this is one of those moments.
Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Are you?
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Chair Monazander?
Aye. HCR 2 will be moved to the floor to be adopted by the Senate, and Senator Farioli and Senator Brown will carry the bill.
And Madam Chair, yes. I would be remiss if I neglected to wish the President pro tem a happy President's Day.
Thank you.
I close
the work session on House Concurrent Resolution 2, and I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 429, and Ms. Palmiter, are you finished? Okay. Vic Todd and Genevieve Sundet.
Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Vic Todd. I'm the administrator for the self-sufficiency programs within the Children's, Adults, and Family Services Division within the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to testify on Senate Bill 429. Senate Bill 429, as you heard, would require the department to fully document the verification of resources as required by federal law. In addition to that, if resources are questionable, it would require the department to follow the requirements as stated under the quality control requirements within the federal regulations. And as the bill is currently written, the department believes that the Children's, Adults, and Family Services Division actually does employ this methodology. That is that the eligibility staff, when they perform the eligibility process, only require the additional verification if the resources are in question. However, in the Seniors and People with Disability Division, within that division, the resource verification process, is more extensive. And that has to do with the complexity of the resource issues that particular population groups bring forward. I think that with this testimony, we're really looking to ask for getting additional clarification on the intent of the bill, and has been suggested we think a work group would be a good approach to get to that place in terms of being sure that we're clear on the intent of this bill. An additional provision in the bill is to ask federal approval to operate a demonstration project with respect to negligible earned interest that clients may have. The department does not believe that level of interest was likely to cause an eligibility decision to cause an outcome where the client would not be eligible. But we would, again, be interested in exploring this further to be sure that we have the intent clear. That really is a summary of my testimony, and I'd be glad to answer questions.
May I ask a question?
Yes, Senator Carter.
In listen to your testimony, I just want to kind of make up a question in the sense of your collective thoughts on this. Due to the many and varied funds that you have in SPD, your need to ask more questions in terms of resources beyond what the federal government asks is necessary because of all these different funding sources.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter. Actually, it's not.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Sorry. Genevieve Sundet with Seniors and People with Disabilities. It's not from the different funding sources. It really has to do with the clients that we serve.
Mm-hmm.
We serve two different groups. One is the group that are eligible for SSI, so they're very low income. But
right.
The other group is between 100% and 300% of SSI. So these are folks that have had resources in the past. A little higher income, and those are the ones we ask for verification of.
Another question.
Follow up.
I think the totality of my question is, why do we have to be more rigorous in our quest to find out what the resources are than what the federal government requests?
I'm not so sure that we are, so that's really part of the reason why we wanted the work group to get clarification.
I get it. Okay. Because I think what they're saying is that people are people are discouraged from making application as seniors who think that they are qualified because of the rigorousness of all the paperwork they have to respond to. And so I think what I heard the 4A people asking for you to do is to see if you can condense the numbers of pages of paper and questions that you ask of them and don't be any more rigorous in what the federal requirement is. And so, like you said, you're going to be going to a task force anyway, and that's something that I would certainly support in terms of you guys getting, because I know that that one of the things in helping my mother fill out paperwork was a myriad of pages, and she'd get so frustrated, and she'd just say, oh, hell away with it. I don't need to go through all of this. And that frustration leads sometimes to depression in our elderly. And so we need to be real, real careful about that. And so, Madam Chair, I'm supportive of the department, and I know how friendly they are that they'd be willing to work on this task force to come to some level of resolution along these lines to make life a little more tenable for our seniors as they progress older in age. I'm not far away from that, and I don't want you guys to be giving me no trouble in about 5 years.
Everybody's not far away from that.
None of us are.
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Mr. Todd, can you comment on the example that we heard from Ms. Palmateer? In her testimony, she gave the example of food stamp eligibility, mm-hmm. and said that there's a yearly redetermination of financial eligibility required for food stamp and medical assistance programs. In your written testimony, I believe if I'm understanding this correctly, help me here. You say that as the bill is currently written, the department believes the current practice within the Children, Adults, and Families Division follows the proposed language in the bill. So where are we exactly?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Gordley, the bill itself does not address food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
It is only addressing the medical. And with respect to the testimony that I had submitted, that really didn't address the question that she raised around a 12-month certification versus a 24-month certification. So I'm going to actually go back and look at that to kind of validate that. I was unaware of a 24-month option, so I want to be sure that that's clear. So in terms of my testimony, Currently, what we do is train staff to look at resources, and if the resource is in question for whatever reason, then they would go to that next level of verification requirement, either through a primary source like a bank statement or, you know, secondary sources, mm-hmm. To do the validation. In the QC process that we have, what we found is that resource issues tend not to be the issue that we tend to face the most in terms of errors. And so that helps to validate the process that we're using with respect to how we have staff treat the eligibility process.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the testimony. A couple points, I think, and to get to what Senator Gourley was talking about, it long-term, it may not necessarily be the application, which would be nice to be streamlined, but the reapplication process mm-hmm. might be something that doesn't need to be as all-encompassing. Just if you have to verify that the data that's in is still current.
Right.
And so I'm hoping the work group will look at that. And also, Madam Chair, based on the testimony, I'm not sure Section 4 is necessary. And I say that from the perspective that it's already current practice. Requesting a waiver is not something we should take lightly because it's an onerous process.
And the way I look at it, the intent is to make sure that those who are eligible have access to services. And having worked in Clackamas County as a public health nurse, yes, I knew that when I went into some houses serving some of these people that obviously someone was doing drugs somewhere. I couldn't prove it. I didn't have enough information. Yes, I would report it. But still, I knew that child and that pregnant woman were getting health care. And to me, that is extremely important. But I know that there are a lot of people that would be eligible that just will not apply, or they let it lapse because their lives are so chaotic that they can't get all of the resources together or the paper together to be able to reapply, et cetera. So if we can make some efficiencies, I agree with Senator Schrader that let's see if we can do that. Any other further questions? Well, then I will have John Mullen and DHS, if you coordinate with Shannon, she can help coordinate a work plan or a work group and see if we can get some amendments and make sure the intent is there, and we'll see if we'll pass the bill or not. Any other comments? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 429, and committee, have a very nice President's Day, and the meeting's adjourned.